Welcome you all here for this book launch of Fatos Lubonia's book, The False Apocalypse. And this event has been co-organised with Istros Books and is also very kindly supported by English Pen. And later on there'll be a sort of reception which has been offered by the Anglo-Albanian Association. So welcome to everyone. But in particular, two people here sitting at the table with me, Fatos Lubonia and John Hodgson, who is the translator of Fatos' books. Fatos, I have known for a long time now. And very often when I've been in Albania, I've always had a chance to meet Fatos. But what I've always appreciated is I can ring Fatos up anywhere in the world and he'll try and explain things Albanian to me. Fatos, as you know, is a writer, and that's the reason why he's here this evening. But he's also the editor of a journal in Albanian called Perpejkia, which means in English it's a much easier endeavour, which publishes poetry, short stories, literary criticism, and political writings. And for as long as I've known Fatos too, he's always been a publicist. He writes in many journals, many newspapers, politically, and features and otherwise. And the thing I always remember is he's never afraid to say what he thinks. And in my struggles over the years to try and find neutral authorities in Albania, Fatos, I'm afraid, is the only one who ever comes to mind. And I really value him for that. But of course, prior to all this, Fatos had very difficult experiences. Fatos, as you probably know, was imprisoned under the Hoyde system for 17 years. His first imprisonment came in 1974 for agitation and propaganda, and then in 1979, which his book, Second Sentence, Fatos's recollections, memoirs of both preparing for his case and his experiences in the prison in Tirana. So in 1979, he was charged with counter-revolutionary opposition. John, on the other hand, is an interpreter who studied English at Cambridge. I'm never really sure when you learnt your Albanian, but you've worked in Tirana, you've taught in Tirana, you've taught in Pristina at the universities, and of course you've translated not only Fatos's books, but Ismail Kadara's books, and you've also worked as an interpreter at the International Crimes Court in The Hague, which must have been a very specific experience. This book, The False Apocalypse, is, as you know, about the situation after 1997, the so-called pyramid crisis in Albania in 1997. I think most of us at the time, we didn't even know what pyramid systems were, and if we did, they were things that happened in small towns, some in different parts of the world. But here was one that brought a whole country to its knees, and we'll all remember the awful scenes of anarchy and, of course, the horrendous violence by the authorities and the cruelty went on both sides. Numerous people were killed. I don't think we really know how many people were killed, but what people often forget was they were actually killed, most of them, by falling bullets. It wasn't a sort of a massacre. And it was during this time that Fatos set up with his colleagues the Forum for Democracy, which is very much the core story of this book. The crisis then results in international intervention, as we all know, and eventually it comes to an end with elections being held which finally result in the resignation of President Berisha, who very much scripted the entire crisis. And Fatos has chosen to tell this incredible story through a narrative technique that operates at two levels: a third-person narrator who describes the large-scale events that made international headlines, and the narrative of Fatos Choori. Fatos Choori, the author's alter ego, who describes his own dramatic experiences in a personal diary. The book begins with the synopsis of a novel entitled The Sugar Boat that Fatos Choori intends to write about, the spread of a small pyramid scheme luring people to invest supposedly in a sugar business. However, as the major pyramids collapse, real events overtake anything he has imagined, and Choori finds himself in the midst of a real life tragedy. And reading this book, for me personally, brought back many memories of those times, because I was then working on Albania at the Foreign Office. And not only was this the first crisis I ever had to deal with in my work there, but it was something totally new to the people I were working with. I can remember with my fellow colleagues, they didn't really know how to conceptualize this crisis and how to approach it. So the book has been, for me, intriguingly beguiling. And what I would like to do before we have some questions is I want to explain exactly why it's had that impact on me. And I will read two or three quotes from Fatos, because I think he can say it so much better than any of us. And I think what everybody will find is you open the book up and you think you're about to read a novel. And it starts as if you'd opened a classic novel with a description of the main character's home, kindergarten number 19, and then evolves into history, autobiography, a memoir, political analysis, self-analysis, personal reflection, a great weave of these two narratives in the third person and Lubonia himself, the alter ego. And it's an impelling read, because it is not just about post-communist society, but a society whose history has never delivered identity, civic integration, a reformation or enlightenment, or any form of democratic system. And this chasm has been further totally adulterated by the Hoyerist system. The communist system is often seen as a reference point, but I think what Fatos shows here in his book so clearly is it's much, much deeper than that. And the characters in the book, as you pick it up and you start reading the first few pages, they all appear as fictional and colourful as novels' characters do. And they have equally distinct, complex, and intriguing identities. But then you suddenly realize they've got their names, like Rama, today's Prime Minister, Berisha, and so on and so on. So they're not fiction at all. But there was one character who stayed in my mind, because I have recollections of a double character of him in Warsaw, in Poland, also after the war. This was the Jew Robert Schwark, who drank coffee and raki with these colleagues, ceaselessly reminding the others to call him Heb, and not the derogatory Turkish term Chifut, as was used under the Hoyerist system. And I had never realized, it was just such a telling moment for me when I read this. And the book was certainly interesting, specifically because I have worked on transition and post-communist systems, both in Central Europe and the Balkans. And it's a very, very specific example. And I'd like to tell you a few reasons why it was so specific for me. Firstly, because of what it tells us about Albanian history and the impact it has had on its people, and how its history has created some form of collective unconsciousness. And I think it throws up the question as to whether we should ask ourselves whether these experiences had have a different impact than those in other post-authoritarian situations. Secondly, for me, it's an important contribution to our understanding of authoritarian systems. It shows the horrendous impact of those systems and how complex it is to unravel all the damage they have done. And I think this is an argument rarely used. We so often analyse why these systems are bad, but we rarely, even today, look in what I would call autocratic democracies, remind people that these systems are so difficult later on to unravel, and in embryonic democracies they create far greater damage. And Fatos says this beautifully. This entire generation of intellectuals with their double lives, opposing the regime and yet collaborating with it, seem to have a tendency to bolt. Their way of life had taught them to never put complete faith in what they were doing, but always to leave an escape route open, and ultimately never to trust one another. In one of his articles, he had used the phrase grey area, which in other countries of the East denoted the region between the black of the regime and the white of the dissidents. Could these people be light grey? In Albania, he believed, there had never been any white, but only black and grey. He did not think of prisoners, including himself, as dissidents, but victims. They served the regime by scaring the rest of the population. Hoxha's regime had been a totally black hole, unilluminated by the rays of courage and hope that Zakharov, Mihnich, and Havel had spread elsewhere in post-Stalinist Eastern Europe. That sentence to me is absolutely key, because that was always something I felt so much when I went to Albania. Only now, after the fall of communism, was the grey divisible into the dark grey of those who had risen to power with Berisha and the light grey of the opponents of the authoritarian regime. But this colour chart did not cover all the shades that distinguished those people from one another. What Chori called light grey had its dark patches. He remembered the rumours that the so-called democratic movements had been entirely in contrivance to the former Sigurimi security services, and that most of its leaders had been its former agents and informers. And this is so important, this sort of concept of there being no kind of dissident culture, because when you combine it with the awful stereotyping of Albanians, and then the conceptualization people make later, it is very dangerous. And I'm not talking here about national character, I'm talking about historic experience. And then the third one is that Fatos talks about what happened, or starts to talk about what happened in 1997 as the first social upheaval in Albania's history. For the first time in their history, the Albanians were showing their rulers that they were able to punish them for the havoc they had caused. This could open a new era and create a new type of politician. But then, as the book goes on, Fatos develops this theme further, whether there really was a watershed moment. And I think at the end I'll say a tiny bit more about this, but this is crucial to the book. And fourthly, I'm afraid, it's his blatant critique and portrait of Berisha, who has dominated Albanian politics for the last 25 years. his ruthlessness and primitivity. You show his methods were compatible to those of Heuge, but you realise he was restricted because Albania was no longer in isolation. And then the next one is a non-political one. And I came back to these sentences several times, but it's how Fatos describes the concept of fear. Those of us who've had the fortune most of our lives to live in democratic and free systems cannot begin to understand, I believe, this fear of people who've had to live in those systems. And yet you would think that Fatos may have been fearless after it all. And then I quote him. It seemed to Chori's Fatos, it seemed to Chori that he had always been trying to overcome fear and repress the weaker part of his nature that did not allow him to become his stronger, full self. That was what the dictatorship had done to people. It made them fear to live and left them diminished. But did not these diminished selves ultimately become real selves? Fear had to be fought against if you were not to be diminished. Chori's relationship with fear had been decisive in his life and in the lives of people among whom he had lived, because in their society, fear was the main instrument of control. It created relationships. But it was also the main obstacle of being free. Since prison, he had established a different, less confrontational rapport with fear and with authority. He was no longer ashamed of his fear. He was more willing to accept it as a part of himself. Sometimes he even thought of fear as a mark of dignity and a respect for life. Experience had taught him that the problem was not of feeling fear, but of not allowing oneself to be mastered by it. It was less a question of not falling than of picking up yourself again. And then the next one, inevitably, is your criticism of the internationals. They get a fair thrashing in the book, quite rightly, including the British Helsinki Group, for siding with Berisha, and their inability to conceptualize the post-war, Cold War situation, seeing everything as either left or right, and believing the opposition wanted to reinstate communism. And here we're talking about Italians, Americans, the awful descriptions of the ramming of the ship by the Italians with over 80 Albanian refugees on it. And again, You so clearly say, because the internationals tended to look for stability rather than human rights and resolution. I've been there, I know it. And then finally, Chori's Fatos, his reason for staying, and this brings us right to the title of the book. And this is at the very end of the book, when many of your friends and colleagues had left. And here are his reasons. And again, it comes back to whether this specific moment in Albanian history was going to usher in change. Chori told the people who phoned him that he had been in the public eye and couldn't run away. But the deeper reason was that he was kept in Albania by curiosity to see what happened next. A curiosity that could probably be swept away at any time by rising panic. But he felt no panic. He had been more frightened earlier. Now it was obvious that this was not a civil war. Nobody had taken up weapons against anyone. Everyone was firing into the air. The greatest danger was the lunacy and desperation of people who didn't know what was going on or what would happen to them in the next day. It resembled an apocalyptic drama. But it was a false apocalypse, a revelation that revealed nothing. It would leave everything just as it was. So his writer's and journalistic instinct told him that it would be a great loss not to live through this false apocalypse that one day he might describe. In fact, all historical calamities had been like this, false apocalypses to which God's angels had failed to turn up. This one was perhaps more farcical than most, but maybe for this reason, slightly more truthful. And one tiny mention, if you like cats, there's a cat in this book. Nussi. And when I read this, Fatos, I kept on going back to your short story as well, The Black Cat, another incredible short story. But Nussi also had an important role to play. So please, please read it. So I'm now going to ask both Fatos and John a question, and then I'll open the floor because I'm sure there are lots of questions here. Fatos, I'm going to go back to that, the whole sort of strand in the book that nothing had changed. It would leave everything just as it was. And I can remember meeting you in 1997 in the Hotel Rogner, and you were saying that so, so clearly. And I understand you still feel that. And so my question is, nothing's changed. What could change it? Do you see any change in the younger generation? Is there any other kind of historical message in a way or influence that's coming through now? Because it's a sort of hopeless ending in a way. In a way.
Of course, when I say nothing changed, in that part of the history of Armenia, mostly I want to say that what we expected from 97 events was to have a new political class which could stop somehow using authority and treating people as their own, let's say, slaves, like it was during the regime of Hoxha and then after. So what has continued, of course not in the same dramatic way, is that we don't have yet this consciousness of in one side of politicians who really try to serve people, and on the other side we don't yet have this democratic feeling of people who force these politicians to behave differently. So because this is not the two. So, of course, in 97, something changed the fact that during this first period of Berisha, I see that as an inertia of the old regime, because Berisha used more, let's say, police, secret services. He kept the national television and in his hands, and he didn't allow people, and we didn't have private television, etc., etc. So this was an inertia of the old regime. With 97, it changed something, in the sense that we started to have much more. So we had these oligarchs, so-called oligarchs, who became rich and or who started to have money during the beginning of the 90s, who had much more possibility than to invest, and they start to invest in media, so we start to have private media. And we created, let's say, the system that we have today. It's a system where you don't control people through police, through secret services, through the control of the main public television, but through a triangle that I call the triangle of political power, economical power, and media power in the same hands, which is somehow the system of oligarchic system that you find even, let's say, in Russia, maybe you find it in Ukraine, when you hear now all these oligarchs, and which has Berlusconi as a model, mm-hmm. so what we imitated in Albania. But still, all these people, when you try to find, so now I'm continuing somehow, because there I say no change in this sense, the sense of democracy, of people who do it, and of new political class. But what happened in general is that this triangle of oligarchs linked with power, oligarchs becoming politicians and media owners, so the same, it's still the casta, the new casta, which has reduced the other part of population in their own somehow, let's say, servants, and the entire population, people generally work for them in a way, and still we don't have the even now I think we don't have the instruments to challenge them really, so they are very strong. Of course, it's a caricature, let's say, of Italian capitalism, for instance, Italian casta, and so somehow, but of course something changes. But sometimes you say to change everything in order to change nothing somehow.
Thank you. I mean, I'm sure there'll be lots more questions. John, my well, first of all, I always feel the translators never get in this country the credits that they should be given. The other day I was looking at literary awards in Poland. Of course, a lot of your work's been translated into Polish too, hasn't
yes,
it? Yeah. And about one third of the people who got them were the translators, not just the authors. I think it's slowly beginning to change here. But for me, reading the book, and I don't speak Albanian, your translation was absolutely seamless. I mean, it just flows so beautifully. But I want to ask you, as having read it and translated, what were the main impressions you came away with? You know, what sort of stays in your memory from having read this book? The book?
Well, reading it as a foreign reader, and specifically as a British reader, what was very striking for me was that this book was not just about something that had happened in Albania, but has a kind of universality. And when Fatos is describing the pyramid schemes, we have had similar things going on. We have had our bubbles and our banks and our financial scandals. We even had a pyramid scheme in Wales last month. It was called Give and Take. And there were some ladies in Cardiff, and they set up this pyramid, and £20 million went in, and 10,000 people were involved. And this was very similar to what had happened in Tirana. And I think of the precarious nature of our own financial systems and how people behave when their dreams and fears are involved in this kind of way. Because I think one of Fatos's outstanding qualities as a writer is as a psychologist. And I think this is evident in this book and in all his books too, that we often the reader, there are often characters or people who are in very extreme situations. In Second Sentence, which describes a prison camp under Hoxha, or here in False Apocalypse, where people have lost their entire savings and their livelihoods and are faced with a breakdown of state institutions. And Fatos is very, very acute in describing how people react and respond in what are in fact quite understandable and in a way rational ways to situations that are irrational and are overwhelming. And he does this with commitment, but also with a certain surgical coolness. And I think this is one of his great skills.
Thank you. Right, the floor is open to everybody else now. Please ask your question. I think in English. Yes, in English, please. All right. Have you got a question?
I do. Perhaps
you could. Everybody actually introduce themselves.
My name is Nashi, and I do always comment on his Fatos's Facebook, his Endeavour magazine, newspaper that he publishes all the time, and it's very interesting. I would like to compliment him. I would say that he reminds me of Christopher Hitchens. I mean, he's a bit of Christopher Hitchens in Algeria, and I don't know if I'm possibly aware of him. He's, it's about Mother Teresa and all that. So there are similarities there. But anyway, so what I was going to say, 1997 I was there, and I didn't have the political maturity of self-captive experiences. I would like to, my question would be, do you see we've got corrupt democracy now? That's what I would call it. Do you see the corruption that we inherited from the Hoxha's regime? Because everybody says, oh no, a lot of people say, in Hoxha's time there was not corruption. All there was corruption. So we inherited that corruption. Mm-hmm. And that carried on in 1997. And we thought that now that has conquered every cell of the institutions. Have you covered that in your book, or do you think that the corruption as a continuation of the Hoxha's regime that we have today in Albania? Do you think that is going to change? Or do you?
Could you hear the question at the back?
You mean if I consider corruption as a continuity or something new?
Yeah, so we've got corrupt democracy today, and we had that in Hoxha's regime. So Berisha was one of the elites, and now we've got another. So the corruption is there, so we're all there. Do you see that as a continuation of Hoxha's regime?
Generally speaking, when I try to analyze Albania, I find it I always consider somehow that part of the dramatic situation that I see in Albania, even now, is due to the old regime. So it's a continuity, of course. In the sense of, I try to describe in the book, even when we consider the elites and the impunity of politicians, and the lack of trust between people, even the corruption in normal, even the corruption as a network of people who try, I think it's very much inherited. But of course you cannot explain everything with the old regime. I think we have to link it even with the what we caught from the West, let's say, from the new capitalist system. I think, for instance, when we consider the corruption, I mentioned Berlusconi, for instance, when we consider the corruption, this big corruption that we have now in the political class, you cannot only let's say, explain it through the, let's say the people who grow up in communist regime, but even the neoliberal system, how we took it without any kind of critical spirit is very important. But most of all, the continuity that I see is in the fact that the communist regime reduced us in children who want to survive. So, in a sense, deresponsabilized us. You were not responsible for your life, even for the other, because the party was responsible of your thoughts, of your education, of your work, of everything. And so it reduced us in children who want to survive, and survival means collaboration. It's Imre Kertész, just when I say. So people who collaborated with the regime. But in essence were people irresponsible. Now, when this big father died, who took every responsibility, we found ourselves without the instruments of building a responsibility towards each other. So we came out from a collective society of people who were not responsible for themselves, in children who were no more under the control of the father, of the big father, and in extreme individualism. So what happened after 91 is this extreme individualism of people irresponsible towards each other because they didn't have instruments to become responsible. So we didn't develop these instruments being under the dictatorship. And that's why what is a lot of things happening in Albania, where people, even if you think of construction, for instance, people build blocks here close to the house or someone, they take the son of someone without caring, they have their own houses very clean, but everything, the garbages are everywhere, and even politicians deal like that somehow. So this irresponsibility is continuity, is the other side of the coin of the responsibility of people during the regime. But this, of course, is combined with the neoliberal system, which somehow legitimized this individualism in a way. So people say, yes, now you have to take care only of your own garden, and you don't care of the others, and so the idea of even Thatcherism, somehow there is no such a thing like society, there are only individuals, and Albanians took it without any critical spirit, so you run for your own interests. And this is a result. The corruption is linked even with that as well.
Okay, there's a question at the back. Could you introduce yourself, please?
Evening, Rex Martin. This microanalysis in regards to both the first question, and I'll relate to the second one. Do you, if you look historically, the history of Albania, from, shall we pick it up from the conference of Berlin, where the great powers decided as to what would Albania be, and then following that to First World War, how Albania was decided, the borders of Albania were decided here at the Athenian Hotel. Following that, Kim Philby's treachery of this government, passing on secret services from KGB. From British intelligence to KGB and subsequent coup d'etat in 1951 or something, got rendered useless. Also, at the end, in the 90s, there was a lack of, shall we say, guidance from the developed and educated world that is the Occident that keeps as the pariah of the world. Do you think this lack of involvement, as direct as it was, say, with Greece and Portugal, when they came out of their political regimes, that the Occident is to blame for Albania's ills? Of course, Albanians have some responsibility, but ultimately, the Albanian state has been decimated, desecrated, and what have you, to the point that Albanians have become victims and are incitors of crime, if we can call it as such. On the second point, I'd like to think, based on what the lady just mentioned about the books and description, did you have in mind Unbearable Lightness of Being, of Kundera's, when you wrote the book? Because there seem to be a lot of parallels and similarities.
Sit my table.
So, your question is as if always during this 102 years since the independence of Albania, we should always blame the West.
In part.
In part. No, but because this is a very, very widespread in Albania, this idea to blame the West. But you have to see the two sides of the coin, let's say. For instance, when Albania was created as a state, independent state, it was during the Balkan Wars. It was the time of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, and the Serbs and the Greeks prepared somehow the war to divide it. And they want to divide even Albania, as you may know. And if you follow the history, not the history written in Albania, but more, I have published some other authors, you'll find, for instance, that Albanians at that time had a chance, because it was very important for Albanians the help given by Austro-Hungarians. Austro-Hungarians were very important in creating Albania as a state. And Austro-Hungarians were pushing Albanians and even pushing the Ottoman Empire to create a kind of, let's say, a sort of autonomy of Albania inside the Ottoman Empire, in order that could be another state after. But it was very difficult to put together Albanians to make this. And in the moment when the Ottomans accepted such an idea, that it was the idea to create this Albania, Serbs and Greeks started the war, the First Balkan War. Now, the thing is, so, first of all, you say the nation state, what is the nation state? I'm very skeptical about nationalism, generally speaking, and I don't think that through the creation of a nation state, we are more or more happy than before, or less happy. This is very complex. But still, I want to say that Albanians were not ready to make a war at that time to defend their own, because they didn't have an autonomy before. They didn't have, so they were part of the Ottoman Empire, and that's why the Serbs arrived till Durrës and the Greeks arrived till the Vlora. And it was due to Austro-Hungarians, not because they loved Albanians, but they didn't want Serbs to go to the Adriatic Sea, the Italians didn't want Greeks to go up. So it was due to Austro-Hungarians especially that Albania, small Albania, not big, great Albania, was created at that time. So you cannot say that we have only to blame the Westerners if we consider that to create Albania was a good thing, you know, because maybe for others was not a good thing. But generally, if you see from the ego of Albanians, you could say so. But Albanians consider it not as a favor, but as a split of Albania by the West, by the Occident. So you can see both sides. Then, generally speaking, I am among those who think that, first of all, we have to look at ourselves, about our responsibilities for what is going on wrong in our countries. And for instance, if you follow why Albania became part of the communist world and not part of the West at that time, you can even blame somehow the great powers and Churchill, Roosevelt and Stalin for how they split it at the time. Of course, you have to blame something, but still, this is history, and Albanians should see their own part, what they did wrong and what they didn't, how they didn't use the opportunities. Even in 91, when collapsed, we were fortunate in a way, because the Berlin Wall collapsed not due to the Albanians, and we were the last ones to open, but without the help of the pressure of the West, would have been more difficult. And as you may know, Albania was part of, it was not part of the Eastern Camp at that time, and we were prepared by our leaders, by Enver Hoxha, to remain, let's say, because the accusation of Soviet Union and other Eastern countries was that they are revisionist, and so they are going to capitalism, which was not true, should not be true for Albanians. And Albania was prepared to be, let's say, like Cuba, like an island, but it was through the pressure, and of course because the economy was collapsing, that the West somehow could intervene, and it happened what happened. But of course, if you try to consider then errors, or as I described in the book, of the West towards Albanians, of course you can find a lot of stuff there. It's mixture history is very complex, and I cannot, but it depends on what you see, where you stress somehow your view, and I am among those who see more our own responsibilities than others.
And Milos Kundera?
As Milos Kundera, no, no, it's not. I have read this book very, very early, I mean after my release, because I, but as far as I remember, he's describing the communist regime in Czechoslovakia at that time. While this is a new situation, maybe there are some parallels, but it's not unconsciously somehow, especially when I try to analyze maybe the elite and the stuff.
There is an existential crisis while the communist collapses.
Yeah.
Thank you. There's a question here.
Can I ask possibly both of you?
Could you speak up a bit?
Can I ask possibly both of you a question about the writing of fiction? Because if our lives have been so, in so many places in the world, have been so overtaken by corruption and falsity that almost our lives have become fictions, how does that place the writer in fiction? How does that change the responsibility of the way you write fiction?
But this book is not real fiction.
No, I realize that.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, you have written other books.
Yeah. My experience is, because, you know, I've been, when I was young, I was writing fiction. Then I finished in jail, and it was a long time. I have written a book in jail, which is a fiction. But after my release, I found myself in a contradiction, because I had a lot, all this life behind, and somehow the idea to write fiction, I was very, very contradicting myself. So you have this story and you write fiction, but what's about your life? So what about your prison life? And so, in a way, I select to write some stories of my life. But they are a little bit. Of course, you select things to that you want to write, and it's, they were stories which, in my view at least, were like in art, like ready made somehow. In a way, they were stories which were a concentration of what I could express from this. Experience of my life, and there are two books, The Second Sentence and this book, are some docu-novel in a way, so they are part of my life, and but fiction and non-fiction, for me it's a bit complicated. I don't like to create a limit border between them. I don't find a limit border between fiction and non-fiction. They are, and sometimes it's the way you live your life, somehow. Sometimes I think that there are people who try to make their life their work, and their work their life, in a way, you know. I belong to this kind of people, and as persons and writers, if and to give a sense to my life or to rewrite what I have lived and to give it another view. But of course there is fiction there, because you in this book, for instance, the diaries are not diaries kept at that time, but all invented diaries using the memory of that time. Parts were diaries.
John,
I don't know if I was clear.
Would you like to add anything, John?
Only that I think this book, for say a British reader, would fall into the category of what we'd call a drama doc, a drama documentary, in that it uses a dramatic form, and it uses the form of a novel, but it tests itself not against imagination, but against reality. So the things described in the book, and this is also true of Fatos's earlier book, Second Sentence, which is a documentary novel in the sense that it puts in dramatic form real things that happened. So there are a lot of conversations Apocalypse, and of course we don't remember conversations over a number of years and so forth, but we remember more or less what happened, and these are put into dramatic form. So I think Fatos has found a very suitable vehicle for describing real things in a dramatic, imaginative way.
Any more questions?
Can we come back to the sort of the points that you're making a couple of questions ago, in the sense that Albania now is a product of Albanian past? That Albania now is a consequence of, is a product of Albanian past.
Mm-hmm.
Very simply put.
Mm-hmm.
Two points, really. One, that is most countries would say that their presence are products of their past. In one sense, it's very difficult for any country to make a break from what has been, unless you have some kind of revolution, and even then, as you pointed out, it's difficult to actually fracture what has gone before. What does Albania do? Does Albania live with this problem? Does it try to address it? Is there a place that Albania ought to be aiming for that you would feel comfortable with? Where does Albania go?
Never.
I was in Albania quite recently, and it seemed to me that there was some sense.
Mm-hmm.
I speak a little bit of Albania,
yes.
There seemed to be a sense of somebody somewhere, possibly the government, attempting to build this kind of sense of a greater responsibility towards other people. For instance, very simply, by having signs over the road saying observe the traffic regulations. Don't speak, don't use your phone when you're driving. And it seemed to me that this was, in a sense, a kind of almost a nascent attempt by somebody to try to build this kind of sense of a greater, responsibility to your fellow citizens.
Yes, of course. Somehow, if you see the rhetoric of our politicians and what we are doing, generally speaking, during these years, there is a future, there is a utopia, let's say. The utopia as the way, as the direction where you want to walk somehow, which is Europe, the West, the model. There are a lot of attempts that, because there is the presence of the West as well, that now Albania had this candidate status for Europe. And in their rhetoric, of course, you see this. if you see our constitution, our laws, everything is just made to be to fit with, let's say, European standards, as we call it. And I try to describe what's going on in Albania, I find two sort of institutions working somehow. It's a facade institution, the facade. Sometimes I call this democracy, this implementation of European institutions, etc., as a facade. And I give importance to the facade. It's not that just a facade. So as a facade, so you have to dress like this to become European, and you have to have this dress. On the other side, you cannot neglect the fact that behind this facade there are some other institutions working very much, which is, let's say, for instance, the organized crime, who is very much controlling the political system. This oligarchic system that it's working behind, let's say, the facade in very authoritarian way, the corruption, etc. Now, the link between these two, if you want to see it in a positive way, you can say, okay, the facade is good because, anyway, there is a sort of interaction between this facade and what is behind. And people, maybe there are steps forward in a way or in another way. When you see it more negatively, you will push more through the behind what was going on behind the facade. And for instance, the question mark now was: should Europeans accept Albania to be part, to give the candidate status, in spite that they have not very big achievements and they have a lot of problems in democracy, in implementing the rule of law, or should they not, because they say you should make your own home duties, etc. This was a big problem. And you can see it in both ways. Yes, they need this facade, is still important. You have to give them courage, and you have to put them inside the family, let's say, and then they can improve. On the other side, if you see what's going on behind the facade, there you could be critical and say, yes, but in this way you legitimize these corrupted politicians because you give them strength and they can abuse then easier because they have this legitimization of the Westerners, etc. So I see both sides of the coin, and honestly, when I try to analyze where we are going, and especially looking even in the crisis in Europe, which has been important for this maintaining this utopia, sometimes I'm very, very skeptical about our future. So what is going on? Is this political class, which is this caste, these oligarchs, and going to improve themselves and making themselves more democratic? So, because sometimes I consider the parties as two bands of thugs who try to control the territory because there is no justice. And without justice, democracy degenerates. So, are they going to improve themselves and becoming more democrats, or is it going to collapse? So it will happen something like in North African countries, where you had these elites which collapsed, and the Muslim Brothers came and they pushed them away. And so sometimes, I don't know, maybe the truth is the future we should see, but it's not easy. Sometimes I have the impression that we can, the tunnel will fall down. We should not be able to open the tunnel and to find the light. Sometimes I'm very much afraid.
Any more questions? Maybe here. This lady here, yes. Could you just introduce yourself?
I'm a journalist at the FT. I was wondering, how is your book perceived and received in Albania proper. Has it stirred any debate? Are people reflecting about it at all? Or no foreign universities or not really?
Yeah. Yeah, there is. The book is published in 2011. It was a time when Berisha was in power, and because he returned to power after just because fact that after all what he made, we had this socialist in power, we made such big corruption that people voted Berisha again, in spite of what happened in 97. So that's why I'm saying sometimes that nothing is changing.
Socialists installed.
They installed. It existed before, as you said, even during the time of Hoxha. but they. Now, so there were two sort of reactions in my perception. So apart from some people who, let's say, liked the book for. The oppositions, because in Albania we still have this idea, this is a reality where intellectuals generally, even journalists, are either with one side or the other side. So the journalists and people linked with the socialist party who was in opposition tried to use it more to instrumentalize the book against Berisha. This was one way. So writing pieces, articles, or in television, and so on. And on the other side, if you read the book, this is a strong criticism against all the political class generally we have produced in this 20 years. It was a silence more from the side of those who are there, not on Berisha's side, but it was more silence. These were the two reactions, despite some people who younger who wanted to know a little bit more about 97, because they invited me to speak or just to explain a little bit what was going on.
Any more?
That's also the second question. Do you think corruption all these years has taken and limited your work?
Has taken?
Mm-hmm. And that is not only people's liberty, I'm talking about politicians' liberty. Because I don't think they feel free. The parliament now, you know better than me, because you read about, we've got people with criminal convictions. So do you see that liberty is being taken away from the corruption?
Yeah, when I try to analyze the situation in Albania, speaking of freedom, I use classification of Norberto Bobbio, his Italian philosopher, when he's speaking about right and left, and he's very much his idea of right and left, center right and center left is he makes the link between he's quoting two philosophers, Rousseau and Nietzsche. When they speak about equality, they have a different option. Are we equal or not equal? And according to Bobbio, so Nietzsche is saying that Rousseau is saying we are equal, but it's all what's going on that we made us an equality somehow. And Nietzsche is saying the contrary, and she's putting the question: are we equal or not equal, or equal? And saying we are equal and not equal. And he links the right and left with the idea that. There are people who have more sensitivity towards equality and people who have more sensitivity towards inequality. And then these two he combines with freedom and saying that equality plus lack of freedom is extreme left, what we had in the communist regime. So extreme left is equality plus lack of freedom. And he's saying inequality plus lack of freedom is fascism. It's extreme right, and that's why it says so. Central left and central right are sensitivity towards equality plus freedom, sensitivity towards inequality, let's say competitions, plus freedom. Now, what's going on in Albania? We were in this extreme left, equality plus lack of freedom. And when you have this oligarchic system where a handful of people control the power, control, so it's strong inequality, and using the medias and using the economical power in order to control people. So is and the fact that we don't have two parties which are one of the left and one of the right, because this is another problem that we have. All our parties, two parties, socialists and democrats who call themselves, they are all somehow representing these oligarchs. Generally speaking, there is a fight between two groups of oligarchs, the right and left in Albania. This is the danger that we are going to the other extreme somehow, the inequality plus lack of freedom, because they become a threat for freedom. And especially if you consider that some of them or part of them are really criminals, in the sense organized crime and power. So they don't like freedom. So this is a threat for Albania. And that's why I'm calling that we should have a center-left party, let's say, so which respects freedom and equality, and to fight, to balance, to represent people. If with two parties who represent only oligarchs and fight for oligarchs, we are in the danger to go to Putinism. With Putinism, I consider the control of power from a big, strong party which has a majority, and the opposition is like to exist there, but very incapable to challenge this small party. This is the danger of Albania if you don't have the representation of people in the parties as a representation of people.
Thank
you.
Demi, you had a question.
So I grew up in Italy, and it struck me the way in which you spoke about Berlusconi as a model that profoundly influenced your country. Now, I'm really sorry that he didn't only room one country, and also you were so sorry about that. My question is, if you would be to choose another model to be your imaginary for Albania, who would it be?
You mean
role model?
You would be to substitute the influence that Italy had in Albania and call that city.
You mean if we had to choose another neighbor? Sorry. to imitate? Sorry.
No, well, another model. To phrase it differently, how do you think that Albania would have developed in a better way? Which sort of model do you think it should have followed?
I think that it's not only a matter of models, of course, it's a matter of finding your own way somehow and not imitating always, because when you imitate still are not grown, you are not grown up, and it's a danger that you imitate this or that. And we should find our own way. But I belong to those who think that when we were in communism, just I mentioned this. Extreme left and extreme right. So when we were in communism, we were more pushing for individualism, for individuals, because we were suffering, we were suffocated by this collectivity. And now I feel the need to have more solidarity, more society, and more. And if I have to choose, of course, the model, I hope that if we imitate, one of my criticisms always has been that since we imitate the others, I'm waiting for the West to change somehow. because this is a problem as well. Because, you know, the transition was considered as if we are on this side of the river, the West is on the other side of the river, and all our duty is to take the boat and to travel and to go to the West, where is the paradise. And we find the promised land. It's not like this. It's the West is moving itself, and the West is going somewhere. So we are moving. Maybe the metaphor is not right, but we are in the same boat, but some are first-class passengers and some are second, third-class passengers. And I am waiting for the West to change, because somehow it has been always a drive for us. And the change I expect, and this is the model I would like to see, is a change that gives more weight to things that are lost in a way. The society, solidarity, and social, more social helps for people, and this system, and of course sensitivity towards the environment. So I was speaking with John yesterday. I gave him a book. I've published a book now, which is written by an Italian economist of happiness, whose title is in Italian is Manifesto per la Felicità. How to go from a society of having into English in a society of well-being, somehow well-being, a system where relationships between people are much more important in order to have more happiness and to live in a better life. And in the West, we don't find it yet, this move, since there are some more, there is more sensitivity about that, I find, but still. And so I'm waiting that Albanians, since they don't really, he has written an introduction for Albanians, as this author, and he finds Albania as the extreme case of individualism, for instance, in his experience. So in the other Eastern countries, it has started to develop this idea of more relationships and more trust in institutions and so on. Albanians are not convinced that they can collaborate and to create things in working in common, just because of the past. And so my model is this model. Which,
I've got a question for John, if I may. John, what do you think this book tells the non-Albanian reader? You know, people who don't really know very much about Albanian history, what's happened. I mean, I know you know a lot about it, but what do you think they will take away?
I think this is a book of considerable historical importance, because it describes 1997, which was an episode in Albanian history which has in a way been airbrushed out. It is like a stag night that went horribly wrong and nobody mentions ever again. So I think this is a very important book of record of something that happened. And I also think that it is a remarkable insight into how Albanian society was operating at that time. That in the early 90s, which is when I also lived in Tirana, there was this warm breath of democracy arrived, and at the same time there was this cold blast of the market economy and shock therapy and neoliberalism. And this created a time of great confusion and illusion. And I think Fautos's book describes this time and place in a remarkable way.
One more. I think we've got time for two more questions.
This is to the panel, and why the, luckily, also you mentioned the word illusion and cold glass that were in there, very metaphorically put. Do you think, considering the ideals and the practice of democracy, that since its inception, it has been corrupted, it has been inculcated from its, shall we call it, to the bone, and in ideal, it works just like communism. Everyone is, it has a right, it has a say into something or other. But ultimately, it's flawed. It's open to corruption. For example, I wouldn't go to a mechanic to seek advice for my toothache, and vice versa. So this democracy, these doors open to having a criminal, in this case, as a member of parliament. Someone who fiddles their accounts, still as a member of parliament here. Others who are accused of even greater crimes, and yet they seem to be impossible. So is this notion of democracy unreachable in terms of practical terms, and yet it's a mirage that people seem to chase?
Yeah, I think one of the problems that this society, this like Albania had, one is that we had, if you compare it, let's say maybe even the history of Britain, it seems that we had democracy before having the rule of law, let's say. I mean, and the question mark is, so there are countries where, even in Spain, let's consider Spain, for instance, after Franco, you had a judiciary system there, of course, who was forcing to rule the law of Franco, but when the system changed, they respected the law somehow. And it, the same judge maybe could work with another, let's say, with other penal code and civil code, etc., etc. But still, it was this respect for law. And I consider that democracy, that is the key point in Albania especially, where you can... Democracy cannot exist without the rule of law. So you should have the rule of law. Without the rule of law, the pluralistic system, which we considered in the beginning as if it's enough to have pluralistic system, so 2, 3, 4, 5 parties and to have democracy, it was wrong. This was the illusion. That now we can control this party, and through elections, yes, we can vote one, and then we can vote the other. It didn't work like that. It didn't work like that because they became stronger, and it's like to have this, as I said, bands who control the territory. But without rule of law, you cannot have democracy. And now, this is the challenge. The challenge, how to build the rule of law, how to build an independent judiciary in a country where the political parties are so strong and the politicians are so strong that they control the judiciary, and this is part of the past, inheritance of the past, because we had the party system who controlled the judiciary system and could condemn everyone because of. And part of the fact that they are so strong that they can pay judiciary, they control judiciary. How to strengthen judiciary to make it in the same level of power with the parties, with the executive, with the legislative, it's the biggest challenge that we have for the moment. And I I don't know, there are a lot of theories and how can we do, what can we do. And democracy, it means it's like, how is it in English? A flood with with ships, the different ships.
Yeah.
You cannot, they have to go together. If politicians are not, the parties are not democratic, so you cannot. And especially I consider the role of medias, which is very important. And the medias as well are part of this system. So they are in service of this power. And this is the biggest challenge that we have for the future to build democracy, to create real independent medias and real independent judiciary. Of course, democracy is a process. It's not something that you reach. So you have to, we have to try every day for democracy. But for the moment, these are the two main challenges.
Now I have three questions. I think I'll just take your question because you put your hand up before.
I identify very much with some of the things you were saying about the two groups of thugs and the oligarchs. And when I go to Albania, I'm always struck by the fact that I've never seen people more passionate about politics. Particularly on television, I've seen the programmes of Blendi Fezziu, where people shout and scream. But actually, ideologically, they're not that different. It becomes very personal. It becomes accusation and counter-accusation. So I identify with all of that. What I'm really sort of interested in, I guess, is do you see a resistance forming to the system as it is? And if so, where is it? Is it you say the media is very much controlled. Is this simply individuals fighting against this, or is this becoming something that's coalescing?
Yeah, in my view, and this is a difference between Italy, for instance, maybe you have heard that in Italy there is this movement of Pepe Grillo, who is against the system, against the both parties, and they have taken something like 20-25% with all the problems that they have, but this is a movement anti-system, or anti-casta, they call casta, and they say go home for both. And there are 20-25% of Italians who vote for this party, at least among those who vote. And of course, there is not such a thing in Albania. I think we badly need a movement which has to challenge both sides and the casta, even just to improve them, even to put pressure against them to improve them. But we don't have, and this I come back to the past and to the psychology of people. So it's not that people don't need it, don't think about it, but they feel in the same time powerless towards the system installed. They feel powerless. And the brain drain has very much contributed about that. Many young people, they go, they leave the country, they think this country it's a big problem. So so we are between the idea that we should have a new movement, let's call it, to challenge this, or to wait for these two facts to improve themselves gradually, improving, strengthening the screws through the help of the Westerners and going on and going on. And maybe something, this is the second way, is more realistic in my view. In spite that I don't like it and I think it's too late and it might be the tunnel will fall down. But still, this is the situation. And there are voices, civil society, who try, but very, 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 very little. German people feel powerless.
We have three more questions. Would you be happy just to speak for another 5 minutes?
Yes, of
if
course.
We take if the three questions together, but let's have them very, very short. There's one here and two at the back. And that's it. Right. Would you like to start?
Yes, my name is Tim Judah.
Tim, thanks.
Interestingly, you work just by coincidence. You come to Britain on the day where, probably for the first time since 1997, Albania was mentioned in the headlines of the BBC Radio. I think it would be kind of unfair to if you didn't make a comment on just what you think about what happened last night, and if you think that that was what are the ramifications of it? Because they're not quite important.
Yeah.
And then two at the back.
My name's Eric Monroe. I have a quick question about, you were talking about sort of what's essential to democracy, rule of law, and media, and you even referenced North Africa at one point, and a lot of sort of non-state controlled things like Facebook blogs are sometimes credited with actually leading to some of the upheaval you see in those places. And I'm wondering if you see an increasing role of, you know, non-state media being used, or is there sort of the potential for that to grow?
And
hi, my name is Andrei Kretschiko, and I always wonder where the new leaders are going to come from. And there's never enough debate in Albania about things like, you know, the social infrastructure, so education, hospitals, and museums, and things like that, which are very important for the next generation of leaders, but also Albanians, you know, that creation of that culture. There's just not enough debate about that. And I was wondering why.
So, football, social media.
Yeah, of course. This is I was following it, and honestly, when I heard about the news, I was shocked and even depressed, even personally, because I'm among those who are of during these 20 years more trying to push the idea that we should leave. Somehow we should try to change the situation, the relationships with our neighbors, in to have to be open to the others, especially younger generations should communicate. We should, let's say, generally speaking, we should overcome this nationalistic stage and to go. And to start this post-nationalistic times in the Balkans, like it happened after the Second World War, in let's say, in between Germans and French, or etc., etc. And I feel depressed, and I feel very concerned when I saw what happened, because what happened shows how fragile is our situation there, and how very quickly people could be manipulated and passions with blow up everything. So, and you know the story, it was this drone, you know, and in my view, so, and I'm following even the Albanian press now and what they are saying. I have not possibility to follow the Serbian press, but I followed some statements from the Minister of Foreign Affairs and so on. Just a drone with a flag over the stadium, the field of the stadium. Of course, it was a provocation of Albanians, but in my view, that now that this is the problem, how it was. In the same time, I couldn't expect Serbs to react in such strong way, in the sense of taking it as something like very dramatic. You could even laugh, but they didn't laugh, and the Albanians could do something more nice, not to this. Map of Great Albania with two heroes, one from the north, one from the south, and so on. But what concerned me more were the reactions. I'm sure that these people who did it are among young generation who wanted to provocate, who are grown up with this idea, and this shows how problematic is our society. But the reaction even from political leaders were not, I didn't like them. I thought, speaking on the side of Albanians, first of all, our Prime Minister could have said something like, yes, this was an irresponsible act of, let's say, provocation, or made by people, and we, this map is not, this is not the flag of Albania, this is, because it was not the flag of Albania, in fact, it was this map of Great Albania. But the reaction was, our heroes who defended our flag. And on the other side, the Serbs who rejected this flag and they in Albania they were just people considered the soccer player, our soccer players, like heroes. The Serbs made it very dramatic as a provocation. Imagine that if the Serbs would have done this in Tirana, this would have been a very dramatic. So, all the entire world should have taken it in consideration. And now the Serbs have always this frustration that they have not on their side the West. I think that this shows how big problems we have in our countries, and nationalism is, as this is already said, the last shelter of the wanderers, or
the last refuge of the scoundrel.
Of the scoundrel. Scoundrel. Somehow, I find this idea. So now I saw people in Pristina very happy, enthusiastic. Oh, what! And in Tirana, and they forget about all their problems that they have. I think the same with the Serbs. And if you consider the situation in Ukraine and so on, I'm very much concerned about this. In Macedonia, we have still this big problem between Macedonians and Albanians. And and somehow the question mark is, even for Europe, what have we done these 20 years, even for us as intellectuals? What have we done during these 20 years? Wrong, maybe. Or have we done everything? I personally couldn't imagine that this thing could happen. But it happens, and this reminds you of the old times when there are people who never thought that the war could start. But this war started. Even the First World War started. And so this has to be taken more seriously in my view.
Social media.
Yes, social media could be a tool, but as far as I see, social media, I find social media, especially in Albania, I am not sure about other countries, but very much instrumentalized again. There are voices that they control, even the parties control even social media with their groups of anonymous who, right? And then sometimes social media is even a place where people can somehow express their frustration, but I'm more for direct contacts of people. You cannot have a movement, so social media could be important as a way to put people together and to create a real movement without nicknames and everything. Because I find that in Albania, especially, there are a lot of nicknames. You can hear many truths, but even many lies there, and a very racist. Even in this case, for instance, I follow the comments of Albanians. They are all nationalistic, very with hate towards Serbs, and so I'm suspicious about the social media's how they can create a movement without closer contacts of people with each other. But still, there is a possibility, I think.
Well, thank
the leaders, how they can come and what's going on. I tried to say before, it's more, if you see the changes in Albania, always they are happening from outside, even the creation of Albania was. And unfortunately. Somehow we are waiting from these Albanians who live abroad, who have another experience, and the osmosis with the West and with these Albanians who have possibility to travel, and they can bring more and more somehow values and human rights values and democracy in Albania, and more respect for the rule of law, and then maybe it will come something new. For the moment I don't find, and honestly I'm among those who are very pessimistic about the next years, at least to see something new. So we are waiting for we are very much dependent on the judgment of the West, of the our politicians try to find their legitimacy through the West, through the Western press, and not find their legitimacy from Albanians inside. So that's why sometimes I think that it could come a trauma before a normal step, a trauma that could give a lecture, and maybe after the trauma that we could start something new, but with all the problematics of the traumas as we see in northern African countries I mentioned.
I think we should leave it there. It's a rather sort of sad note to leave it on. And we seem to have come back to the point of, you know, whether there's really any change or hope of change. As a member of the LSE, I would just like to tell you about the next two meetings in the Visiting Speakers Programme. Next Tuesday, the 21st, Gejim Krasnitschi will be here talking about the political orientations and internal power struggles within the nationalist movement in Kosovo between 1968 and 2008. And then on Monday, the 27th of October, there'll be a lecture by Serbian Prime Minister Aleksandar Vučić, but you will need tickets for that. But they will be available as of Monday, the 20th. I'm sure everybody now would like to have a drink. The books are also here for sale. In my thanks, I would like to say something that I always remembered that Fatos said to me. In fact, it was only last year. I was talking to Fatos, having read his Darkness at Noon, his second sentence, and so much of the book is about struggling to get 25 years in solitary confinement and not the death sentence, which I found just incredible when I read the book. And I said to Fatos, you know, I can't understand this. You know, I think I know which one I would have chosen. And you said to me four words: I wanted to write. So thank you. Thank you for your resilience. Thank you very much. Thank you.